Dirk Helbing. Dirk Helbing is a professor of computational social science at the Eidgenössische Hochschule Zürich, but he originates from physics. He is a physician, and he earns his degrees in physics, but as we will see now, he is a guy who wants to build up bridges between social science and computational science, bridges between modeling and computer simulation and real empirical data science, and a bridge between fundamental and applied work. And the talk of today will be about digital society and sustainability transition. The floor is yours. Thank you very much for having you.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me for the closing word. These days, we're reading this kind of news. We hear scientists don't make propaganda, and of course, politicians don't want anybody else to mix and mess with them. But I'd like to reply to the politicians, don't listen to lobbyists, read more science, because we're 10, 20, 30 years late in regulation in certain fields and in the necessary action. And here's some of the science I think which is relevant for the future, for the digital transition and also the sustainability transition. There's no doubt our society is a complex matter, and in particular, the biggest problem we probably are faced with is lack of sustainability. We are overusing renewable resources, and that's why back in 2015, the United Nations Sustainability Agenda was established. And so there are basically 10 years left to accomplish these goals, almost impossible, in fact, which shows that politics is pretty late. But the question is science keeping pace with development? So in the past, for example, we have been using a lot representative agent models, right? For example, in economics. And so basically there's one agent that's being influenced by an average of all the other agents. Or you could also kind of try to represent it in this way. And I will show now that this approach has really serious limitations, as of course most of you are aware of, and I'm demonstrating this for a simple model of fighting global warming, where we assume four different strategies, one being cooperation, one being defection, I mean non-cooperative behavior, one that we call moralists, that are cooperators who punish defectors, and finally immoralists, who punish defectors even though they defect themselves. Now, if you analyze this game, assuming that everyone interacts with everyone else or with randomly chosen interaction partners, then what you find is immoralists disappear quickly because of the punishment costs, and then basically you stay with cooperators, moralists, and defectors. Cooperators crowd out moralists because of that extra punishment cost that moralists pays, and then cooperators stay in the game with defectors, and you know how this ends in a social dilemma situation. We'll have a tragedy of the commons. This is not necessarily happening if people interact in space with their neighbors. So now we're simulating the very same game, assuming that people interact just with their nearest neighbors and imitate the best performing neighbor strategy. And then starting with an equal distribution of these four strategies, we see that in the beginning, in fact, defectors spread, and you would think defectors are taking over the world, you know, the end is near. But in fact, this is not happening. And why? Because there's a segregation effect occurring. The moralists are actually separated from the cooperators by defectors, and that protects them from the cooperators while they can efficiently fight the defectors. So eventually, cooperators are crowded out by defectors, but more or less win the game. And here is also a short computer simulation for those who don't believe it. Like Herk Gintis couldn't believe it at one of our workshops, and then he was sitting down in the evenings and programming it himself until after, I think, 3 evenings, he told me, "You're right." And in fact, this game is much more interesting than just this outcome. There are many more possible outcomes depending on the parameters in the game. But the main message over here is a representative agent model could be totally misleading if we consider neighborhood or network interaction, even the opposite could be true. And so there is hope for the world, in fact. And also, one class of models that's quite common is deterministic models. And I'm here coming back to some work of Michael Mays. In fact, this is the Michael Mays show today. And so we've been looking into a situation of decision making where we were able to predict decisions with 96% accuracy with a deterministic model. But on the other hand, we had a situation where the model obviously didn't describe the experimental outcome well. And the reason is that in this particular game, perturbations, it means small, perhaps random changes, could really mess up the situation and produce a completely different outcome. So there is a sensitivity, we would say. And interestingly enough, adding noise to this deterministic model, which would make you think this is going to deteriorate the quality of the model, actually improved the predictive outcome of this model in being able to reproduce the macroscopic picture that we get in our experiments. And depending on parameters and payoffs, we actually find 3 different possible outcomes. One is anomie, everyone does what he or she likes. One is the establishment of a social norm, where one kind of people basically adapts to the preferences of the other group, even though they have different preferences, and then there is coexistence, I mean kind of local norms, and actually there is a model that allows us to produce all of this, and so here and there a social norm is established, over here we have anomie, and here we have local norms formed, and here's just an example for the outcome of a computer simulation. I could also send you a video demonstrating how we get towards this when we start with a pretty random initial condition, just assuming that people tend to pressure minorities that, you know, randomly would occur after some time. And so eventually you get these local cultures. And of course, we all know about it. Another thing that we need to consider these days in the social sciences is that we are all being targeted, and there is the attempt of behavioral manipulation. We are living now in what some people call an attention economy, where we're overloaded with information. And that makes it simple to manipulate people to some extent, and we don't have any more markets in the sense of macroeconomic theory anymore, because every one of you would see a different price. And you would think, oh, they're making me a good deal. And in fact, as they know your income and what is on your bank account, they would probably just rip you off in the most effective way and still make you feel good over this, you know. Like, so there's personalized pricing, and all the theories that assume a market where we basically match supply and demand on average is, I believe, not anymore applicable. So economic theory needs a complete reinvention for this digital age. We are now living in times of neuromarketing, where basically everyone of us is being surveilled by what some people call surveillance capitalism. Our computers, our smartphones are delivering all sorts of data. Every link that you click is basically recorded, and altogether that creates digital doubles that are highly detailed. And you can even look into this. There are companies like Crystal Nose that show you the personality to some degree of your neighbors or your boss or whomever, you know. And these profiles are highly detailed. Probably Secret Service know a lot more, but this tells you something about the character of the person and the activity profile. And moreover, there are projects that have laid out, that have mapped the cognitive biases of our brains. Our brain is just using 100 watts, while Google's AI is using as much energy as an entire city. So our brains make simplifications, it takes shortcuts, and that's why we have these cognitive biases, I would guess. And in other words, we can be manipulated, we can be tricked. And basically, for all these biases, those digital tricks have been developed that are aimed at manipulating us into buying certain products or voting for certain political parties, as we know since Cambridge Analytica. And so to some extent, there is an attempt to program us with a stimulus response scheme with personalized information. And if you think I'm exaggerating, then you should listen to Tristan Harris, who has worked in a Google control room and reports in his TED talk how a handful of tech companies controls billions of minds every day. You can assume yours is included, and maybe you have not even noticed that you were manipulated because of these filter bubbles that are really highly personalized information worlds that you typically like. Yeah, feels good. But this is applied really on a massive scale, and knowing so much about you, more probably than your own friends, allows some companies and institutions that we may not even know to manipulate your behavior. And that is the outcome then. Now, China even goes a step further, and they're now testing a social credit score, and basically everything that people do or don't do would get plus or minus points, and it would impact your credit score and the possibilities of what you can do, whether you can still use a fast train, how fast your internet would be, the jobs that you can still get, and also the countries you can travel to. This is what some people call technological totalitarianism. And even in the West, people get excited about it because China is so efficient. But you know, if you look into the cities of China, then this is what you basically see. You see nothing because there's smog. I don't see these cities are more sustainable than our cities. So why the excitement for this Chinese system? And by the way, coming back to experiments in the lab, this is what we found when we were looking for the effectiveness of scoring systems in terms of supporting cooperation. And it turns out, apparently, they can't stop the decay of cooperation in social dilemma situations. So the tragedy of the commons would anyway happen. There is another problem that is related to networks. As we are part of many different social and also in other networks, basically there can be an interlocking effect, something like a topological enslavement. That means behavioral change becomes pretty unlikely. If we don't meet other people with different opinions, who would change our thinking about certain kind of things? So this brings us to the next point, which is really important. We need to consider social networks. And our world has been ever more networked every year. And that is changing the dynamics of the world. And everything in a sense is influencing all sorts of other things, and so the intended effect may not result. Instead, we might see side effects, feedback effects, and cascading effects. And also as a result, this prime example of big data analytics of the early times of big data, Google flu trend, doesn't work anymore, partly because they're now manipulating our search behavior. And so this site has been closed down. And instead of just using a brute force big data analytics approach, we need data science. So science comes back into the game. Special knowledge of different subject areas. So we have also been looking into the spreading of epidemics. And if you look at a globe where whenever somebody falls ill, it flashes up at this place, at this time, we'll see a pretty chaotic flashing pattern, quite frustrating. You see widely scattered data, so basically no clearly visible pattern. And that is a result of air travel. Now, if you consider travel volumes from city A to B with all the airports in the world and then define an effective distance based on this additional information, then it turns out you can understand the spreading behavior, you can determine the origin of the city, and you can predict what are the likely cities to be hit next and prepare for the spreading of the flu or some other disease, right? Now, there are a lot of unwanted network effects. I already mentioned cascading effects. And they're actually pretty common. So a little perturbation could actually mess up the entire system. If you think, well, this is a pretty theoretical system that you're showing us over here, then unfortunately there are some real life examples such as this one, the bankruptcies of banks after Lehman Brothers went bust. You can see hundreds of banks actually went bankrupt, and it cost us hundreds of billions of dollars. Pretty much a very similar dynamics. And now, of course, we have networks of networks, and that makes things even more problematic because we could have cascading effects that spread from one network to the next, and it can easily cause disasters or amplify disasters. And so we need to think how to handle this. You need to be able to stop these cascading effects. That requires engineered breaking points. And one of our recent papers could make a contribution to this. It's about generalized network dismantling. But we don't always have to cut links brutally, as maybe you might think if you look into this kind of approach. It might be enough actually to charge or tax excessive links, which cause systemic risks. And in fact, what we found, I think there's a problem with the battery over here. Anyway, what we found is, if we look into a situation where people interact with their neighbors, again in a social dilemma situation, then if you add some random shortcuts, some random links, we could call this a globalization dynamics, it would actually increase cooperation. And so we would decide to go on networking with others because it's improving cooperation. But there's a certain point where basically cooperation starts to go down as we go on networking. And that is maybe a surprise for many people. So as a result,
thank you. As a result, actually, it could have been that the financial crisis back in 2007-8 was a
result of over-networking in the banking system. And another result of this decline of cooperation through over-networked systems is that a lot of countries have invested into armed police and all sorts of measures to enforce cooperation. Now the question is this the only way to establish cooperation in a globalized world? And the answer is no. There is actually a lot of decentralized mechanisms that can also establish cooperation. And I'm coming to another piece of work with Michael Mays, which is looking into different mechanisms that are compared in competition with each other. And we look at the efficiency of these different approaches, and turns out there is an approach that is more efficient than costly punishment, which is altruistic signaling. But there are other approaches too, such as merit-based matching. I mean, people would be matched based on the level of cooperation that they have shown in the past, and it would actually create a trend towards more cooperation. And of course, there are publications about this. And we could also look into the question, okay, if we match people based on merits, what should be the criterion? Should it be investments made, the contribution, how much you pay? And of course, that depends on how much money you have. Or should it be talent? And actually, it turns out that as we go on, eventually we should see a systemic change where talent starts to matter more, and hopefully we'll see that in the future, that not money will be the most important thing, but talent will become more important. Now, there are also desired network effects, and of course, in these times of crisis, we need in particular a resilient society that can recover from problems quickly. And that can be supported by diversity, by decentralization, by distributed control, subsidiarity, and so on. It makes basically cities and regions relevant units to look at and to act in. So one of my future projects, an ERC Advanced Investigator Grant, will look at how to make smart cities smarter by adding in collective intelligence. And you know, could we upgrade democracy with digital means? We call this digital democracy. Now, maybe you have seen this block over here, Brexit, the first major casualty of digital democracy. And so basically, it was suggested that people are too stupid and democracy is basically about to be dead soon. And the reason is understood much better in the meantime, because if you influence people in their information gathering, decision making, it can actually deteriorate collective intelligence and can actually create quite bad outcomes. And in the meantime, of course, we know about the opinion manipulation that has happened during the Brexit vote. You've certainly heard about Cambridge Analytica. And so we would have to do it in a different way. I mean, upgrade democracy digitally is obviously not an easy thing. And one question is, would democracy survive at all? One thing I really need to point out over here is we shouldn't see society as a machine. There are many important things that matter for humans, including human dignity, love, consciousness, creativity, and so on. They cannot be well quantified, and so in a data-driven society controlled by AI systems, that would just get lost. So it would tend to be an inhumane society, and so we would have to approach the problem in a different way. And it turns out that this idea that China is the best possible models for the future is not empirically well backed. Here is a preprint that looks into a large data set that suggests democracies are still superior if you make a proper analysis. And there are many publications that show that there is a benefit in diversity and collective intelligence can improve the outcome. So if you take the best individual solution, combine it with worse solutions, you would be surprised that in many cases you would get a better solution that works for more people, and that's the secret of collective intelligence. So in particular, if you have a complex problem, then you need to look at it from different perspectives and then find some integrated approach. And here's also a PNAS paper which has looked into ways of improving beyond today's majority voting in democracies and beyond the performance of markets with an incentive-based approach that takes more observations and perspectives on board. So the challenge is really to bring the best ideas of many minds together. And in fact, we have done a computer simulation in order to figure out, would people, as a result of biological evolution, really be selfish, as we often assume with the model of the Homo economicus. So we have simulated in the computer a model with utility maximization and the possibility to consider the payoff of others in the utility function, but we would set friendliness to zero in the beginning. I mean, everyone is totally selfish, but there is inheritance to children of the degree of friendliness, and there's some mutation rate, or you could say maybe innovation. And if you combine all this, then basically you get these kinds of outcomes over here. And surprisingly, there is a corner where people tend to have other regarding preferences, and where basically a situation occurs where people are not just cooperative, but also have a fairness preference, and that will give them much higher payoffs eventually, but it takes many generations to get there. And this kind of thing can be supported actually with digital technology, I think. It means this other regarding behavior, a way to benefit from interactions that don't exploit others. So we should now with digital technology really engage into co-creation. And one format to do it would be City Olympics, where basically there would be friendly competitions between cities for the best solutions for reducing climate change, increasing energy efficiency, improving sustainability and resilience. And the outcomes would be open source and Creative Commons. I mean, everyone could take them, develop them further, combine them with each other. And in this way, we would really create something like a global collective intelligence. So the approach is thinking global, but acting local and diverse, experimenting, learning from each other, helping each other. And it's very much consistent, actually, with Elinor Ostrom's polycentric approach, the Nobel Prize winner's approach. And we have a first instance on a very small scale of such a climate city cup running right now. So the idea is to combine competition, collective intelligence, experimentation, and intelligent design. That means the best of all the systems that we know. And to get sustainable, I think it's important to realize that society is a complex system, cannot be steered like a car. Our body is not at all controlled by a one-dimensional quantity such as money. There are many real-time feedback loops. There is a multi-dimensional control and feedback approach. And this is what we are proposing to get from that situation. We're wasting a lot of resources due to linear supply chains. And turning this into a circular economy using the Internet of Things that would allow us to cheaply measure externalities like noise and CO2 and all sorts of garbage And we would then want to have feedback in the sense of increasing positive externalities and reducing negative ones, and that could be done with a multi-dimensional finance system that can now be built with blockchain technology, for example. That would introduce new forces into the market in this way, close those circles eventually by co-evolution, create a circular economy and sharing economy. And that's what we have been working on as far as we could with the limited resources that we have. We could call it participatory sustainability, a socio-ecological finance system. And so I'm closing by saying that network effects can make all the difference. We now experience a transition from a component-dominated world to an interaction-dominated world. And so if we learn to use this, we can increase collective intelligence, also combinatorial innovation, I didn't talk about it, and we can implement this multi-dimensional real-time feedback to benefit our nature. And so I personally think it's really possible to enter an age of prosperity and peace, and the digital revolution could help us to get there if we use these opportunities the right way. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dirk, for this impressive academic statement, as I would call it. Unfortunately, time has run forward. We may have time for one urgent short question. Is there any question left? Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. You presented a lot of material to us, but what I gather is that your talk basically had two parts. On the one hand, you presented kind of this dystopian view of the surveillance society. On the other hand, you gave us a lot of hope with, you know, this massive data collection, what we can kind of get out of this. But how can we kind of manage or balance the trade-off between these two different sides of massive data collection?
I think at the heart of this change from dystopian to utopian is informational self-determination. That means who controls our personal data, and it should be us, because that is what human dignity implies. But presently, that's not the case. Now, interestingly enough, there hasn't been a legal decision about who owns our personal data and who is supposed to control it, right? So a single court decision on a high level could really make the change from dystopian to utopian. And this platform for informational self-determination that I'm demanding would benefit the economy on the one hand, in particular small and medium-sized companies, spin-off companies, also scientific institutions, by the way. But it would also benefit us citizens, and it would benefit society, because we could really help unlock the value of big data for our future. And I really like to, without doing propaganda, but I'd like to urge our politicians really to make sure human dignity and informational self-determination will be also the core of our society in the future.
Again, thank you very much for your talk. Thank you.